So Jake mentioned this morning, let's try and get these glasses and mic balanced up and be able to see you at the same time. It's quite complicated. I'm going to jump ahead. I'm going to talk a little bit about dukkha or difficulty or suffering. One of them is aging, and it gets more complicated as you age, doesn't it? Well, certainly with eyes. Last time I was on a retreat up here, I realised the advantage of varifocals, which is a new thing for me. It's nods in them. Yeah, it's funny how personal experience really brings something much more vividly to light and appreciation. So this morning, Jake spoke of the fourth foundation of mindfulness in the framework of the Satipatthana Sutta. And if you ever look it up, you'll see that the fourth foundation is mindfulness of dhammas or dhammas, which is another Pali word, which is kind of referring to teachings. That's one translation, teachings. And teachings can be used to mean different things. It can be used to mean the teachings of the Buddha, as recorded in the suttas. And there are lists and lists of teachings. And actually, in the fourth foundation of mindfulness, it lists several of these teachings, which are themselves lists. You'll get to know if you don't, of course, need to do this, but if you are sort of interested or start to read into the Buddhist tradition, you'll realise that there are a lot of lists. And we've been presenting the four foundations of mindfulness, and I'll be giving another short list as well, a couple of short lists, in fact. So, and I think this is likely to be, as I understand it, because of the oral tradition that the teachings were transmitted in, that those who remembered the teachings of the Buddha passed them on in ways that could be remembered and recited. So I'm not a scholar, but I'm guessing that the lists we now receive are these formulations made to memorize by monks. So the fourth foundation, yes. Yeah, so there are a few of the teachings that are sort of brought out as particularly useful to contemplate with mindfulness. And as Jake said, one way of, that this fourth foundation is used is to particularly focus on two aspects, two of these teachings, the hindrances, which Jake has already spoken to, and what are called awakening factors, which are these brighter qualities of mind that can be that we have and can be cultivated that really create helpful conditions for understanding and insight and freedom. I'm not going to be going through those today, but just to mention that approach. So the other approach that Jake mentioned was applying the teachings to daily life. Yes, so that brings me back to dhammas. So dhammas can be used to mean the actual written teachings, and they can also be used to mean life itself is a teaching. And we have been, you know, really using both of those on this retreat. The teachings, the sort of suggestions for practice, but really it's only in the light of our own experience that we learn. And there's this metaphor, finger pointing at the moon, that the words are kind of pointing to an experience that is beyond words. One thing I love about this tradition, and I love about the 8-week courses as well, is that they're so focused on experience, practical experience in the moment, which I think is, you know, where deep learning happens. So I'm going to take one of these teachings from the Satipatthana Sutta's own list of teachings, one of the ones it pulls out, but perhaps take it in the spirit, if possible, of these are some teachings as I understand them, and that they're pointing to how we can kind of utilize and learn from our lives, which seems very appropriate as we're contemplating now returning to our lives from retreat, or carrying on in our lives off retreat. So the one that I'm pulling out is one that is quite famous and well known, and I'm guessing many of you will have heard of this. It's the Four Noble Truths, which is one of the maps, and perhaps the most famous map that the Buddha reputedly gave to offer an explanation for suffering and a way to reduce suffering and potentially end suffering as understood by the Buddhist tradition of what suffering is, and a way to cultivating that. So the noble truth of dukkha meaning suffering, the noble truth of the cause of dukkha, the noble truth of the cessation of dukkha, the noble truth of the way to the cessation of dukkha. So I'm using the word dukkha, which we haven't really used on this retreat so far. Again, a Pali word. And I like to use it myself because it is broader than one kind of suffering. So in MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, we talk about stress as the name for what we're working with and aiming to help reduce or relieve or find some freedom with. When I use the word stress, I tend to have certain ideas of what that means, and a certain image of myself when I'm stressed and other people are stressed. Dukkha is really referring to a very wide spectrum of everything from really subtle dis-ease, dissatisfaction, unpleasantness, discomfort, to anguish, you know, and extreme suffering. It's referring also, and linked in with those terms, to a never-ending cycle of craving and aversion, caught in this always trying to adjust things to make things just right. And just right never really lasts very long. So it's kind of, you know, tiring. I guess that's why stress is tiring. And an image from the tradition that I like, because it kind of, really sort of speaks to me, particularly of the kind of more minor end of the scale of dukkha, is the etymology of the word dukkha. One origin is to do with the axle of a wheel of a cart. Some of you may have heard this before. So if you've ever seen a cart, I don't know, maybe you could imagine something like another kind of wheeled vehicle, like a bicycle or a pushchair or a wheelbarrow. But I kind of like carts. I've seen them in parts of the world. And the axle is the hole. I'm not a mechanic, so I hope I've got this right. It's the hole where the shaft of the wheel goes in. And then the wheel is there. And it's a misshapen hole. So as the wheel turns, it can't turn smoothly. So it's bumpy. And if you were riding that cart, it would be a really bumpy ride. And I think we often use, don't we, in English, a kind of the metaphor of, gosh, that was a rough ride, or that was a bumpy ride when something was challenging. I think one of the sort of blind alleys that we can sometimes, or others who hear about the Four Noble Truths can get caught in is because of the word truth, the sense that, oh, these need to be believed. Somehow I have to take on this as a belief system. Particularly the noble truth of suffering, of dukkha. And friends of mine have said, but life is not all about suffering. I'm not interested in Buddhism if it's all about suffering. You could say fair enough, really. It's like, who would want to, you know, suffer just for the sake of it? Two things I'd like to say to that. One is that there's one of the teachers from this centre called Stephen Batchelor who particularly likes to emphasise that he doesn't feel it's useful to get caught in this belief dynamic, but really to see these four noble truths, quote-unquote truths, as injunctions or tasks that can transform life. So they're kind of practices, really. You don't have to believe them or not believe them, but see if they help lead to greater ease, release, happiness. If they do, great. If they don't, you know, don't use them. And the other, I'm guessing it's a riposte to the idea that Buddhism is miserable, all about suffering, is that apparently in the time of the Buddha, the monks used to be known as the happy ones, which I find comforting because sometimes when you read the suttas, if you do read them, they can look like, gosh, you know, really, were they contemplating these really challenging things of suffering, of the ways human beings can suffer, of mortality, they're eating once a day, gosh, that looks like a hard life. But they were known as happy, and people wanted to join them. So there was obviously something there, you know, for them that drew them to it. And actually the monks and nuns I've met who do practice this more austere form of Buddhism, generally, I have to say, are really light, lovely people to be around, as I've experienced it. So there's some trust I have that these teachings do lead in a good direction when used well. And I guess that the acid test is actually judging by your own experience, do these teachings, are they leading to a sense of something that feels helpful and good? So when the four truths are turned into tasks, the tasks become that dukkha is to be understood and that the cause of dukkha is to be let go of or abandoned. The end of dukkha is to be directly experienced, and the way of practice leading to the cessation, the end of dukkha, is to be developed or cultivated. So the first truth, the noble truth of dukkha, is to be understood. So, yeah, so thinking about dukkha and the different kinds of stress, dis-ease, dissatisfaction, and real kind of poignancy and challenge of life. And I'm really aware that, you know, there's a lot of that in this room, you know, that we've come from all kinds of situations where we've been touched, many here have been touched by life's difficulties and stresses, as I have, as I would imagine every human being has. So one kind of dukkha, of challenge, is literally, you know, what comes to us as a human being through life. The bereavements, the losses, stress at work, health challenges, challenges of family life. You know, and I think particularly at this time, not having lived in other times, of course, but it seems to me there are so many strains in our culture, in our bigger systems, that are impacting on us as individuals. You know, many of us have connections or work in the NHS, and how hard it is to, you know, be open and sensitive and work in the NHS without being impacted by the stress of a system that's under-resourced and under strain. Is it a political leaning there coming up? But, you know, probably most managers in it would say under-resourced. And of course, you know, other societal issues, you know, with rising costs, so many challenges for so many of generations, whether you're older or younger. And then the challenges of climate change and these huge global, you know, issues that we're increasingly aware of. Sometimes I do find myself thinking, why be alive now? Why now? Why, you know, being here at this time? And I'm not sure if that's a common question or not. But, you know, as if somehow I could do something about all of this or be born at another time. I find it helpful to remember that, you know, for whatever reason, here I am. And that for whatever reason, I am a recipient. We're recipients of the conditions of the world at this time. And it's not our fault. It's not something we can really claim responsibility for in the past. But we are inheritors of past actions, of past generations, and of our actions ourselves in the past. You know, we are just receiving the conditions of a changeable life with inevitable joys and losses. We cannot change the past. And as I said, in a way, you know, I can't change the mind state I had in the past. It was a result of other conditions. There's a phrase that I find, when I first saw it, I found it very powerful. I don't know if you've heard it before. It's apparently from an American actress who I didn't realise, called Lily Tomlin, is quoted to have said, "Forgiveness means giving up all hope of a better past." Don't know how that strikes you. Forgiveness means giving up all hope of a better past. And for me, it's like, yeah, you know, I can't change the past. But what I can do, and really significantly, is I can have some influence over how I meet the present moment. And that will affect the future moments. The Buddhist tradition outlines three kinds of dukkha. I told you there'd be lists. Three kinds, which maybe encompasses it all, I'm not sure, but it's certainly perhaps most, if not all, of that I can think of as dissatisfaction and dukkha. The first is getting what we don't want, the conditions of life that we don't choose but come to us anyway. The frustration that the pleasure that we do get doesn't last. And at a deeper level, the dukkha, the frustration at a basic instability of everything. That actually everything really is not properly graspable. It won't stay still and solid in our hands. Everything is constantly changing from moment to moment. All beings, all plants, all animals, ourselves, our mind states, even as we look at it, even the way of looking can change experience subtly. So where can we really stand? And that can, of course, be very unsettling and can sometimes perhaps be a reason why there can sometimes be an underlying kind of subtle stress of not really feeling at peace. If peace is dependent on things being a certain way and staying that way. So the first noble task is that dukkha is to be understood. And Stephen Batchelor, who I mentioned, has quite a nice, I think, or interesting way of reframing that. He frames it as life is to be embraced, actually. And that reminds me of John Kabat-Zinn's phrase, full catastrophe living. Embracing the full catastrophe. Of course, one needs some resource to do that. It's a big ask. But, you know, to whatever degree, turning towards the reality of difficulty and dissatisfaction or pain or challenge, because by doing that, it offers us the possibility and the route to seeing beyond it and seeing some freedom and some peace and some happiness that isn't dependent on things being a certain way. So I think of, the different levels of turning towards life, and sometimes we just have no choice, you know, here it is, and, you know, just having to deal with it as best we can. But I think it's really brave, you know, for example, people who are in the grip of severe addiction, and maybe it's quite common to have, you know, mild, you know, tendencies to really lean on something for comfort in a slightly addictive way. But people who have a more severe addiction, it's really, really hard to admit it. I don't know if you've come close to people who are in that situation, and just how brave and humble it is to hear someone actually say, I have a problem and I need to do something about it. And what a big step it is to turn towards it. And all that means, their self-view, their view of life, but also the possibility that something could be different and better. And it's not possible, I think, to recover from addiction unless you can make that first move to recognizing that there is a problem. I also think of, you know, the people that came to John Kabat-Zinn's clinic and the people I've met on 8-week courses, and maybe you've met if you're a teacher on 8-week courses or been alongside as a participant. You know, folk that recognize that actually that there are challenges in their life and they're looking for a way of working with them. And the bravery of participants to actually do that on a course, not easy, but can be so, so productive and, as Jake has said, life-changing. There's a beautiful poem by Naomi Shihab Nye called Kindness, which some of you may know because it's often used as a teaching aid in mindfulness circles. So it's a beautiful poem, and I'm not going to read it all because of time and also because it maybe takes us in a slightly different direction. But she says, before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing inside. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. And as well as kindness, I would say also, before you know the possibility for freedom, and in a way kindness can also take us, it takes us in that direction too, softens us beyond what we thought, you know, can break us open in some way, sorrow. And I remember John Kabat-Zinn talking once I think I heard him on a talk talking about the size of the cloth of dukkha, the full catastrophe living. But I also like the image of catching the thread of sorrow, because in a way, you know, I do feel we don't have to take on the suffering of the world. That is, you know, perhaps too much to ask of anybody. But we can follow our own threads, and those threads will connect with the whole cloth, actually, and trust our own piece, you know, of the world to work with. I'm just going to take a little pause, because I've spoken quite a long time about the first truth, and it's quite, could be quite poignant, this subject, and perhaps inviting you, if you're touched, to just connect with your body and your breath. Maybe take a few breaths. Feel the ground beneath us. Perhaps the bigger holding of the ground and of space, of life itself. Okay, so I'll carry on with the second noble task, the cause of dukkha, the cause of stress and suffering, dissatisfaction, is to be let go of or relinquished. So this means investigating the causes and letting go of them, two not easy things to do. But actually, this is what Jake was speaking about last night, you know, which I really appreciated his explanation of dependent origination with the example of walking down the sidewalk or walking down the pavement, too American. You know, and he outlined very beautifully and I think in a very, for me, accessible way of how a whole world of suffering can get created so easily from one small moment of someone you know walking by without waving. So in looking at the causes and letting go of them, I was thinking, asking myself the question, what is it that brings the freedom and flexibility of mind in that situation that Jake was talking about? So I'll kind of talk over in some ways some of what he's already said, but just to remind us. But starting with, not sure if he did mention this, is kindness, befriending, this quality that we've been practicing informally in mindfulness and directly in the metta practice. I think that is a really helpful way of reducing reactivity and supporting flexibility and the ability to, yeah, entertain other possibilities. Because if you remember in that example, in the reactive mind state, what happens is they don't wave. There's an interpretation of some kind. Might be they don't like me. And that's it, you know. That is the reality, and all the stress follows on from that. Kindness and befriending and that mind state can really, I don't know if you've noticed, but it can soften the system. It basically is draining aversion out of the system, ill will. And just it's just an environment where the mind can think of other things, particularly on the theme of goodwill and of kinder possibilities. And with kindness as a one way of letting go of dukkha, it's really any access point at all into a more kindly attitude. So in that example, it might be quite hard if you thought someone was ignoring you on purpose to immediately be kind to them. that wouldn't come to me, because, you know, I'd be hurting, because I would be believing my interpretation, and then it's very natural to feel hurt. So I think that's why we emphasize so much, and why it's often so helpful to offer kindness to oneself. Because it's really where can kindness come in? And often it is to oneself and to the reactivity itself. Before even questioning the reality of what's happened, it's just, oh, wasn't nice to feel that. Or bringing anyone or anything to mind that helps us remember a kindly attitude, you know, a good friend, or something else nicer that happened that day. And then also what can help, slowing down the reactivity, grounding and soothing. Of course, kindness is part of that as well. And this is what we were practicing at the beginning of the retreat in particular. And it's once those things are online, it becomes easier then to start to examine the experience and deconstruct it, as Jake was discussing last night, to actually start to question the solidity of the interpretation and start to entertain, well, oh, maybe, you know, do I really know? Just to remember even to ask that question, is it influenced by a mood? Or by something that happened, you know, last week with that person? Am I just making an assumption? So starting to open it up, and it means that there is less place for the craving and aversion to carry on building. It may still be around, but it's starting to reduce. And you may recognize that these are the kind of steps that we practice with rain or grain that Jake offered us earlier this week. The G, the grounding, which could also be soothing, and anything that helps us reduce our flight, fight, freeze, reactivity. And then the recognizing, like recognizing that I'm not feeling happy, I'm stressed, turning towards the dukkha, embracing life, but also recognizing that actually I don't necessarily really know the truth of what's happened here. Allowing the experience that I'm having, bringing kindness, and then investigating what really is going on here in the body, in the heart, in the mind, and then nourishing what's going to really support me in the situation. Take some time out, think about it later. And then the non-self, which is recognizing that actually whatever experience I'm having is really not me or mine, it itself is conditioned. So for whatever reason, I have a propensity to make this interpretation, and that's what's coming up, flowing around in its different components within me. And then if one's really interested in going deeper with Buddhist practice, we can also bring in really powerful insights of practice into impermanence. You know, that actually once we start to really practice and realize the unstable and changing nature of things, it starts to loosen experiences and make them a little bit more flexible. You know, we might think, well, this is how I feel now, I'll probably feel different in an hour's time, you know, or the world around me is constantly changing. Oh, I feel a little bit better just looking at that change. Or just recognizing the dukkha in the interpretation I'm making. If I carry on thinking like this, it's just going to bring me suffering, and I don't really want that. And non-self, at a deeper level, this sense that actually whatever's happening through me is a conditioned arising right now. And I'm not saying these things are not easy to access in the moment, but they can be really powerful practices to weave into our lives, and then do start to give us more general flexibility of mind and possibility of applying them in more difficult situations. And these sort of deeper practices, in a way, are really recognizing that third cause of dukkha, which is the basic instability of life, but actually using that to our benefit. It's like, yes, I know that. And that's actually really freeing to know that. This may not make sense to you, or it may do, but when one practices these things, these practices that are about the more basic instability of life, they generally bring in a sense of freedom, of love, of kind of joy. And so contacting them can be really, really fruitful. So that brings me to the third noble task, which is the cessation of dukkha, of stress, of suffering, is to be directly experienced. Freedom lies in the actual experience. When whatever stress we were feeling suddenly dissipates because we've seen through it. The moments when something falls away, there's a letting go, there's an insight into how whatever was causing us that difficulty or suffering wasn't really the reality it seemed. So this may have happened to some of you on this retreat in small moments or bigger moments. So it could be, for example, a shift in self-view. You know, I thought I was this kind of person who couldn't do this, and then actually I've done it. And suddenly the sense of self changes, something drops away, a limited perception drops away. You know, or a pain that we might have thought this will last a really long time, you know, this whole sit, or maybe the catastrophizing mind got hold of it and you were thinking forever, you know, and that my health is about to deteriorate. And then we just see for a moment the flickering of Vedana, and actually this is more than I thought, and this isn't the solid reality I thought it was, and the freedom that can come with that realization. You know, shifts in the way we think of the world, as Jake gave the example that, you know, something goes slightly wrong and I think the world's a terrible place. And then I realize what's happened, and actually, oh, the world's not only not a terrible place, but it could be many things. It's like the possibilities start to open. He mentioned Beck's triad, the way we tend to make assumptions about ourselves, the world, and the future. And when things drop away, often those things start to open up our views of ourselves, our views of the world, and our views of the future. You might like to check that out when you have a moment of letting go or release. It's like, oh, is that affecting how I think of myself or the world or the future right now? And, you know, I don't know if you've seen this sort of thing happen on eight-week courses, you know, with when people come with a particular painful experience, whether in the body or mind. Sometimes it can happen, again, with that walking down the street exercise, as people start to map out their thoughts, their feelings, their sensations, and their behavioural reactions, and people start to realise actually there's no one way of looking at this. There are many ways. For some people, it's like, oh, something really lightens. It's almost like beyond words. It's like there's a sense of freedom from constraint. Somehow things are more copable with. There's more possibility. As Jake gave that example in MBCT of that powerful realization that a thought is not a fact. This doesn't determine who I am and who I will become. So in the third noble truth, there's something about developing the taste of freedom, of liberation, of the release of stress. And that taste sometimes can be quite subtle, sometimes can be quite powerful. The Buddha in the teachings talks about the one taste the one taste of freedom, just as the ocean has one taste of salt, which is really strong. Ever tasted it? So the taste of nibbana, it has one taste. Nibbana means this freedom, this release of suffering. So when these moments come, it's really worth appreciating them, letting them sink in to the system, letting them nourish us, and if possible, understanding them, because then they may be able to be repeatable when similar things happen again. So the fourth noble truth, we're almost there, is the way to cultivate the end of suffering. So the end, or the reduction of stress and suffering in the moment, but also a lifelong path, potentially, if you choose to take it. And this is the Eightfold Path, which really is a map which could encompass all of life. And this is the way all of life has a relevance to our experience of both difficulty and suffering and happiness and release of happiness, which makes sense if you think of it, that all life is conditioned from moment to moment. So what happens in any one moment is going to affect future moments. So how we live our lives and how we use our time has an effect. So just briefly, the Eightfold Path is, again, I know that I'll be saying some things that people know here already. It's in kind of three sections. There's the wisdom section, there's the ethics section, and there's the meditation practice section. And the wisdom section starts off with view. And it's the assumptions we make about the world and our understanding of the world, particularly this understanding of dukkha and the causes of dukkha, has a powerful effect on our lives and in all the things that follow through on the Eightfold Path. So if we understand to some extent conditionality, and we understand how craving and aversion create suffering and what encourages those things to get going, once we understand that, then it's quite natural, because generally human beings want more happiness, that the intentions that we form in what we want to do and how we want to do it come from that place, if you see what I mean. If we're mistaken in where happiness is to be found, if we think, I will be, the more money I earn, the happier I will be, and I'm not saying money's wrong, and it might bring certain contentment and ease, but if we have the belief and the view that the more money I earn, the happier I'll become, then our intentions will follow that. That's where we'll direct our life, that's what we'll focus on, and maybe, you know, treat quite harshly things that get in the way of that. So the importance of view, which is why in this tradition of insight meditation, there's such an emphasis on insight and understanding of what causes our difficulties and what can give their release. And then following from the skillful intention, skillful intentions in the tradition are goodwill, harmlessness and simplicity. Following on from those, it affects potentially our speech, our actions, the ways we choose to spend our time. And then our speech and actions and the ways we choose to spend our time have an effect on how possible it is to practice, to meditate, to practice the gathering and calming meditations and the insight meditations. And the more we do those, the meditation section, the more it will inform our view, our understanding of life, which then will help us in the practical, everyday concerns of our lives. And so this Eightfold Path, in a way, all these factors of the eight steps are mutually reinforcing and supporting of each other. And I just want to, I will come to an end really soon, just to finish really, just wanting to acknowledge just how challenging I think these times are that we're in. And I feel it's, to my mind, it's really helpful to acknowledge that. And to consider how valuable these practices and skills that we are cultivating on this retreat and other practice areas, you know, whether it's in your own practice or in other retreats or other teachings you listen to, just how valuable they may be for these times that we're in. It strikes me that it's really crucial in these times to learn ways to be as well as we can and to really support our resilience, nourish ourselves, how helpful it is to become skillful at grounding and soothing, learning how to nurture our inner well-being, and how helpful it is to train in clarity, to understand how the triggers that will come our way can be understood in a way that reduces the chances of us adding to them and increasing the stress of general life. You know, for our own sakes and happiness, and also for the sakes and happiness of others. You know, it's very complex. Our world and our actions and the influences that come through us. And we can't change the past, but we can make a difference in how we meet the present moment. And our actions will condition future moments for ourselves and other people. We're always adding to the web of conditions. So although we can't, I believe, really take on the suffering of the world, actually, we can do something to help reduce our own and hopefully that of others, and maybe it will make a difference in some way. This path is as much to do, I feel, about freeing us up to be able to make intentional choices about things that really matter to us. And as the stress of life ramps up at times in our lives or in conditions in the world, so it becomes harder, I think, to make the space to think what really matters to me and how do I act in a way that really aligns with that. But perhaps this path really can support that, to take time to make the space in ourselves, in our minds, to be able to remember what matters to us, what we love, and how to make choices to follow that through. And this is in the territory of week 8 of the MBSR MBCT courses, where we ask, I think, I don't know if it always happens, but it often happens that we ask participants, what really matters to you in your life? What actually motivates you? And could your practice be in service of that? Whatever it is, your family or particular things that you do that you care about, causes that you care about, you know, whatever it is. Because then practice becomes very meaningful. It's supporting us to live a meaningful life. That brings me to that phrase, active hope, which Jake mentioned last night. The sense that we can be active participants in the future of this world and actively contribute to a future that we hope and wish to see. So I'll finish there. Thank you for your patience. It's a long talk. So maybe we can just take a moment to rest into the silence. Maybe just noticing what's here in your body, heart, mind in this moment. Letting the words fall away. Tuning again to breath and body and ground, whatever supports you in your practice.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.